You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and this week I'd like to continue on with our guest and the subject of programs for All Things Cage for the last couple of weeks, Stephen Drury, a pianist and conductor long on the faculty of the New England Conservatory of Music, where he directs its resident Calathumpian consort. This week we're talking about Cage and conducting. Since across his long career, Cage made special demands upon conductors, beginning with the Seasons in 1947 and ending with his works for orchestra written in time bracket notation. Stephen talks about his experiences with conducting Cage, as well as the ways in which Cage's compositional directions that affect conductors also affect the way in which he directs his ensembles. We close this week's program with Cage's 101, a time bracket notation work composed in 1988 and premiered in Boston the following year, performed by the Boston Symphony Orchestra, for which it was written. The BSO's conductor at the time was none other than Seiji Ozawa, who in this case did not conduct the work, but rather prepared the orchestra for its performance. For this work, the orchestra is divided into three groups, each producing a different kind of music. The strings, along with the clarinets and flutes, play sustained tones, quietly and full of imperfections. The brass and double reed instruments interrupt twice with a blast of sound, once at the beginning of the piece and once closer to the end. The percussion instruments, some of them quite exotic, play notes that are scattered over the duration of the work. 101 should be performed without conductor, although the conductor can serve as a rehearsal coach, which is often the case. The work was composed using flexible time brackets and, like all of Cage's so-called number pieces, consists only of parts with no overall score. We'll listen this week not to the BSO's performance from 1989, but to the recording made by the New England Conservatory Philharmonia, directed by Stephen Drury, released on Mode Records in 1994. Not incidentally, Drury was one of the original pianists who performed with the BSO for the premiere performance. This is Mode 41, John Cage Orchestral Works 1, which also includes recordings of Cage's Apartment House 1776 and Ryoanji. So welcome back to All Things Cage, Stephen. It's a pleasure to see you again after so long.
Thank you, Laura. It's so good to talk to you again.
I've had so much fun listening to so many of your recordings. I honestly had lost track of how many recordings you've done of Cage's pieces. And you've done a lot of orchestral works, which are the, you know, in many ways, the least known of Cage's works. And they span a very long time of his career. I mean, the earliest being the Seasons in 47. And then right up to the end, he was doing his number pieces, the time bracket notation pieces. So they stay with him throughout his life. Thinking about you and the orchestral works, I have recordings in which you're a player, recordings in which you have directed the ensemble that now is being conducted by someone else or not conducted at all. And I have recordings that you've conducted. So you have this varying relationship with the role of a conductor in Cage's works. Tell me very quickly some of the works that you've done of Cage's so the audience knows what we're talking about.
Wow. And in terms of work with an ensemble.
Yeah, large ensembles.
Right. I did have the opportunity to conduct a student orchestra in the Seasons back in 2012, of course, in Poland, which is... I've also played the piano reduction of the piece, and I just adore that piece so much. It's a spectacular piece, and it's so of Cage's nature at that time, and in both versions. I mean, the nice thing about the piano version is you don't have the variety of orchestration, which is beautiful in the orchestra version, but you can hear the cells, the gamut elements make up the piece.
Absolutely, absolutely. For our listening audience, The Seasons was Cage's first real orchestral work. It was a one-act ballet that he wrote on a commission from the New York Ballet Society. It had sets and decor by Isamu Noguchi, is used as music for the eponymous dance by Merce Cunningham, but the same title. And the orchestral work came first and the piano work came second. And as Stephen said, he always thought of it as kind of the rehearsal score for the orchestra.
I forget if the number of strings are specified, but it's a real orchestra piece.
Yeah. It strikes me as like a kind of Mozart orchestra.
Yeah.
Not a Wagner orchestra.
Yeah, right.
All right. So that was the first, was that the first piece that you ever did of his? That was an orchestral work?
No, that was the earliest piece of his that I did. The first large orchestra piece I was involved in was 101, which he asked me to be involved to play the piano part when he made the piece for the Boston Symphony, which was during the year that he was at Harvard that year as the Charles Elliott Norton lecturer.
And the conductor was Seiji Ozawa.
The non-conductor.
Yes, the non-conductor, of course.
I mean, the wonderful thing about talking about 101, I was just thinking about this earlier today, about the difference between 101 specifying not to have a conductor. All of the musicians have timers. And they have the time brackets that in their parts, as opposed to Atlas Eclipticalis, which has a conductor or the concert for piano and orchestra, which have conductor parts, especially the concert, which is we should talk about in some detail, the conductor part.
Hold your thought there. We just leapt from The Seasons, which is 1947, Cage is a baby, to 101, which is one of the very late number pieces. And 101, by the way, we talked about the number pieces last time we were together, I think, Stephen, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the number pieces, just to refresh our audience memory, that the number pieces are so-called number pieces because more often than not have numbers as titles. And the titles specify the number of parts, which is sometimes the same as the number of players, but not always. And 101, interestingly, is the number of players in the Boston Orchestra at that time. It was 101 players. However, the piece is actually titled 101, as opposed to 101, to differentiate it from Cage's physical address in New York City, which was 101 West 18th Street.
Also, because I suppose if you were really to pronounce it, it's the capital O in 101 is a round, completely round circle. If you write the number on 101, it's the zero is an oval.
That's right.
And I know that John loved that idea of these straight lines surrounding a completely round circle. But right. Yes, 101 players. Two of us actually in the premiere on a single piano, myself and Frank Epstein, the percussionist who did the bowed piano notes. And you know, one of the things that was interesting of that is a lot of the large ensemble number pieces, Cage was exploring this idea of cooperative anarchy, the idea that we didn't need a conductor. He specified no conductor for 101. Because he didn't want the appearance of a boss.
Right.
And Frank and I, rather than using two pianos, had to use a single piano, which means that in my realization of the piano part, I had to accommodate those bowed notes that Frank was doing inside the piano so as not to run interference, but to have those dampers open so that he could bow the notes. So that like two, the 99 parts and then the two of us who really did have to work together to make.
Of course. The interesting thing about the number pieces, which 101 is among, and that would be 88, I think, right? 101, I think is 1988, might have been 89. My point simply being that it is antagonistic to think of the number pieces as being conducted, because the players are part of the beauty of the number pieces and the time bracket notation itself is that the players are choosing when to insert their musical materials and when to end them based on what's going on around them. So to have a conductor telling them when to come in and when to stop is antithetical to the
right.
Number.
Right.
What did Ozawa do? Do you remember, Stephen?
He stayed the hell off stage. One of the marvelous things about the performances in 101 is that the orchestra tunes, and then there's a moment of, you know, calm silence, and then the music just starts
out of
nowhere with the players making the sound. It's interesting to compare that in terms of the conductor to the two et cetera pieces, both of which have multiple conductors, both of which came about because Cage was interested in this idea of not wanting a conductor, but coming to terms with the fact that orchestra musicians, as often as not, really like to have a conductor, really like to have someone telling them what to do. So in et cetera, you start with this free group, and when they choose, the musicians go to one of the conductor's stations, the three conductors. In et cetera 2/4 orchestras, you start with four small orchestras, each with their own conductor. And at any point, any of those players can get up, which is something that you don't see happen in many orchestra performances unless they're doing one of those pieces with offstage trumpet. Get up, leave the orchestra, and go to a solo place where they're not conducted.
Interesting, interesting. I wonder, Stephen, you know, you just raised an issue. I'm not an orchestral musician, but I am a longtime chorister. So I sang with the San Francisco Symphony for years. The San Francisco
I didn't know that.
Symphony Chorus. Yeah. I just lost my train of thought. Oh, no, only that as a chorister, as a musician working under that conductor who's also led you through rehearsals, who's shared with you his or her feelings about the piece or how they're approaching it, you create or you develop a beautiful rapport with the conductor. So I wonder if that ever comes forward for people as musicians in these pieces where all of a sudden they don't get the conductor anymore. The conductor has taught them, has rehearsed them, has prepared them, and then is, as you say, the hell off the stage. You know, it must be a very funny experience.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking about this in terms of the earlier pieces. And I think one of the great mistakes that was made historically in Cage performances was the notorious New York Philharmonic performance of Atlas Eclipticalis, which was conducted in quotes by the machine, the little kind of clock that was made to stand on the podium in place of Leonard Bernstein and give clock time to the musicians in the orchestra. New York Philharmonic is problematic enough. I think, I don't know whether it was, I imagine it was Cage's idea, but I think it was a mistake not to have Bernstein on the podium in the performance doing the clock circle that was
the
originally
chronometer.
Yeah, the human chronometer, because his presence would have, one hopes, kept those, insert expletive here, players of the New York Philharmonic from behaving as badly as they did. I saw in the 90s maybe, or early 2000s, a rather unfortunate conductor for the Boston Symphony, whose reputation has deservedly been trashed as a human being since, but gave a marvelous performance of Atlas Eclipticalis physically on stage. This was Maestro James Levine, who could barely like lift his arm in the straight up position to show 12 o'clock. He just did it with his hands, but he was present. He was facing the orchestra. And, you know, I remember seeing Ozawa conduct movements, or Bernstein, where they didn't move, but their presence made the orchestra focus.
Exactly. Yeah, and so I just wonder, I'm not sure that I would like to redo my own history as a chorister without those conductors that I got to work under, you know, because it just was so musically so important for me, you know, to actually be guided by these people. That said, the number of pieces, you know, but those are the culmination of Cage's life. We have a lot of pieces in between these, like, you know, what about Cheap Imitation? I love this piece. And, you know, I never got to hear it without conductor until 2013, which was when MTT did it with the New World Symphony in his Cage Centennial Festival called Making the Right Choices. I was very, very much looking forward to the first time I would ever get to hear this piece done without a conductor. So that to listen to an orchestra who absolutely had to listen to each other, they had to, because the piece itself is this long melodic line that moves from one instrument to another instrument. You can almost feel it moving through the orchestra, this melody that's going on. And I remember when I got there for the festival, I was kind of just an advisor. I was there just helping. And I found out from MTT that he was going to conduct it. And I was so disappointed. Right. And I told him so. And I said, you know, nobody doesn't conduct it, you know, and I was really looking forward to seeing what your orchestra would do with that. And then he didn't conduct it. It was fantastic. It was absolutely beautiful. There's another instance where the conductor, in this case, a he, in that case, he taught the orchestra
how
to play, and then he got it out of the way.
Well, especially with Cage's, you know, even going back to the Seasons, that's such a huge element of, particularly of doing John's work. I think it's going to be an element for every good serious conductor, you know, in any piece from the repertoire. When Cage was at the conservatory for our festival week, we did a performance of Cheap Imitation, the small orchestra version. And I remember asking him, because the score does say without a conductor, and I said, you know, I don't think these kids are gonna, he says, that's all right, it's fine. And Grant Llewellyn conducted a marvelous performance. We most recently with my group, Calathumpian Consort, did a performance at the, this was quite a while ago, at the Boston's Gardner Museum. The new hall is a square and the audience sits on four sides. And my ensemble sat in the performance area in the center as a complete circle. So there was someone facing, you know, wherever you were in the audience, you were facing someone's back and you were facing someone facing you.
Nice.
And the
nice.
Musicians were all facing each other without a conductor. And it was a marvelous experience. Need for that, you need people who are really committed and really care and don't just show up and wait for the downbeat.
Right. And they want to, you know, they want to learn how to do that. They want to see if they can do it. It's a challenge to them.
Yeah. That's a tremendous visionary piece of music. Yeah. That, another piece that I've had the opportunity to work with players.
Before you leave that though, I want to go back to Atlas Ecliptikalis. Tell the listening audience what happened with the New York Philharmonic. Not everybody knows this. Not everybody. So among musicians, it's a thing.
Hey, what did John call them? Bandits, I think, which is more printable than I would indulge in. There's an old tradition, unfortunately, of just, oh, this is John Cage, we'll do whatever we want, and playing random noises. But they actually, in some cases, smashed the electronic equipment that they'd been given to amplify and modify their instrumental sounds. Made noises and acted up. They just completely misbehaved. When we did 101 with the Boston Symphony, there were musicians in the orchestra who didn't approve of the music, but they played their best on stage. They gave it what they could. The Philharmonic, the Notorious, this was during a festival of avant-garde music that Bernstein did, I think, in 63. And the players of the orchestra just acted like jerks. I should have been arrested.
He was really mad. I'm not sure, but I if memory serves, I think Cage himself had to purchase new electronic equipment for them to use.
That's right.
But had they done that again, they would have been held to pay.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was so mad.
Yeah.
And then going back to Cheap Imitation for a moment before you leave it, Stephen, you said that you played it for the full, the large orchestra version.
No. I've never even seen or heard of a large, the 93 player version. That would be spectacular.
96.
Good luck finding 96 players that'll pay attention for 45 minutes. No, we've done it a couple times, the smaller version with my group and at New England Conservatory, and also played this, the original solo piano version.
Yeah.
Which is also a difficult transformative experience to just play one melody for, you know, what is it, 40 minutes.
But again, that's, you know, there's that melody that, you know, that's key to the piano piece. That's all it is this beautiful melody. And that's all it is. I say that with emphasis because it's everything that it is.
Yes.
That. But it's all it is. It's this melody that's performed by all these rippling musicians next to each other, you know, taking on the melody from the person next to them or across the room. And you've got yours in a circle, which is beautiful. So you've got looking at each other.
Yes.
Yeah. So really, really nice.
Yeah.
So in that case, in Cheap Imitation, it also, that piece premiered, I want to say it premiered in 72, which was the year it was completed. And it was premiered in The Hague.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so poorly done and conducted that Cage declared it after it was all done a public rehearsal, because he thought it was so poor, which is probably why he said to you, oh, it's okay. It's okay. Go ahead.
Yes. Anything that would help.
He'd had a battle already over this, you know, he wasn't going to do it again.
Right. That's it is really a wonderful piece. That commitment to draw from the players is so crucial. And like I say, that's an element that, you know, Anders Nelson's has to bring from his players during Shostakovich as well. But in my own work, most of my work has been with student ensembles, and they are, you come into a situation where you have a little bit of an advantage in that respect, that you can make this part of their fundamental education.
Right.
So when they're doing a piece like, the first piece that he taught, that Cage talked about using the conductor as a kind of a chronometer, the orchestra part for the concert for piano and orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
What I do is I tend to get together with each individual player and look at the part, which takes a lot of work, a lot of transcription, a lot of involvement on their part, and a lot of it's all tons of extended techniques. Talk about, you know, how to do this, what your options are, which decisions you can make at the moment, how to make those decisions. Do you hear something and say, oh, this would go nice with it? Or do you hear something and say, this would highlight the difference? Or do you proceed completely independently, not knowing? And then, of course, be ready to follow the conductor, who acts like, you know, just like the second hand of a watch, except that watch speeds up and slows down, which was so brilliant on his part to say, okay, here's, this is what would happen. Now, here's one more monkey wrench to throw into the universe of unpredictability, that the musicians, the instrumentalists won't know until they're actually in the performance. They've got 30 seconds of material. Oh, I got to get this done in 15 seconds because he's going, that stopwatch just went twice as fast. And this is all laid out in the part for conductor.
Exactly, exactly. Well, Stephen, but isn't that, it's just yet again, this whole thing of having to be mindful for the entire piece. You can't just tap your toe in time with the music, you know. And then glance up at the conductor every now and then because the
Absolutely.
conductor is changing, you know. So it's just calls for this presence of these musicians in a way that Cage would have said that they're not taught to do that. They're not taught to be present. They're taught to follow, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And it extended that not in the same unpredictable way, but in a similar way in the role of the conductor in Atlas Ecliptica, where he asks for the conductor to be at least twice as slow as a real stopwatch would go on. And there, I think one of Mode Records' earliest releases on LP, if I remember correctly, was from a performance of Atlas that John conducted in Seattle, which was, is it 4 hours? I think they took, if memory serves, they took a dinner break
Really?
halfway through. And it's just, 20 seconds of silence and then a single clarinet note. And it, I'm remembering our last discussion where I said this is a tone poem. This is the night sky, and there is this one isolated star. But of course, the piece was made from star maps.
It's amazing.
I can't imagine holding my hand between the 0 minutes and 15-second mark for 45 seconds. I think I'd like my arm would fall off.
Exactly. You have to be fit in order to do that. Merce said it was incredibly. He did the town hall version of the concert he conducted. And he said it was enormously challenging. You know, and you see pictures of him with he's got, you know, his leg pointed out to the left when he's putting his arm to the right. He's doing all these sort of balletic positions, which was all his doing, you know, that's not in the score. Anyway, so we've already covered a lot of stuff. You know, in the seasons, you have a traditional conductor's role. You have someone who literally is up there telling you when to come in, when to be quieter, when to be louder, when to cut off, when to swell, what's the crescendo here, how big, you know, all of that gets conveyed by the conductor. You've got in concert, you have someone who's being a stopwatch. They're being a human chronometer. They literally are moving, putting their hands together at 12 position and moving one arm, joining the left to the right, and then taking it up back up to 12. And so the musicians have something familiar to look at, although they're not getting any interpretive instruction.
And of course the crucial difference is that there's no score to any of the pieces after Concert for Piano and Orchestra, because the parts are this aquarium of materials.
Of fish, I like
And
that, of fish music.
if I'm playing the violin part, which I think is it 16 or 32 pages, I can select any amount and I can, I'm usually told by the presenting organization or the conductor, it's going to be a 20-minute performance. How much material here would I have available for 20 minutes? The conductor doesn't know that. There's no way of lining up what the violin playing is going to be with what the trombone playing. These materials, and any one of these could be all by itself,
Isn't
too,
that marvelous? I just think it's
without conductor.
marvelous.
I did ask him once how he listens to music where there's more than one thing going on the same time. And I think this is an example, but I was also thinking of pieces that use recordings where there's two different records playing at the same time. And John said, I try to listen to everything, each thing. I think one of the biggest jobs of any conductor is to listen and to conduct the concert for piano and orchestra, to listen to each player singly, as well as being aware of the whole thing. That attention that the conductor on stage gives to the players is crucial.
It's also the unrepeatability of those performances that is critical, you know. So you have you see this very clearly in the number pieces. It's absolutely crystal clear. So those players are choosing when to start whatever it is that they're instructed to do. They can start that within a certain time bracket, and they can end it within a certain time bracket in an overall time that's set for them. But there is no way for the conductor to know when they're going to do that. So to have a conductor would be folly, because there is nothing to conduct. What the players need is a sense of time. They need to be able to, you know. Have you worked with digital timepieces, digital things hanging on the walls, like in your operas 1 and 2?
Yes.
Just that.
Yeah. Yeah. We've done when we recorded 101 with the New England Conservatory Orchestra, which was a situation where I was coaching, and like I mentioned, there's no conductor on stage, but you know, directing the rehearsals, the players all had those little, I don't know if they even make them anymore because everybody has phones now with stopwatches.
But then it's a real problem to get them to make sure that they've turned off the ringers.
Yeah.
All of that stuff.
Turn off your phones.
That's right. Except all we wanted to do is be a watch. I mean, a clock, a little.
Right. Yeah. But I think you can still get them. Little timers that are about the size of a quarter. That, you know, usually have magnets on, you stick them on the fridge and I want to boil an egg for 3 minutes, and you punch in. And you, we gave those to all the players when we did 101.
Right, and they also stick on to music stands.
Yes, yes,
they're
indeed.
Magnetic, so they would stick. We used to have, I remember using them, they were a little plastic.
And yep. You have to take the beeper out.
Yes, exactly, because
otherwise the piece always starts with 101.
Exactly. And then if for some reason your timer stopped working properly, you'd have that little sound again somewhere. You know? Yeah. It was maddening, actually.
Yeah, we've done some of the smaller number pieces. It's easy enough to put somebody's laptop in the center of the semicircle and one player's, or just everybody nods and starts their phone.
Stephen, I think I should know this, and I think we even have it in the archives, that Andy Culver made a digital, a little program that you could put on your computer. I think I even have it on this computer. We just don't need it anymore, you know, because we all have our own stuff.
Yes, I have one too, I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was Andy Culver making that at John's request. And then for your operas, for example, that's a place where you needed that digital timepiece, if you will, in 20 locations, you know, all these different points on the stage and behind the orchestra and in front of the orchestra, where you're changing your clothes, all those things had to be synchronized. And so you couldn't do it with independent timepieces. You had to have some central picture that everyone was going to be looking at.
Yeah, well, you know, it's really, I think the most obvious and maybe the least crucial aspect of a conductor in the traditional sense is to beat time. This came up in the context of discussing some of Earl Brown's pieces with one or more conductors, is this idea of what can you do without a conductor? And my own claim is that the outfit like the Boston Symphony, an upbeat, a downbeat, and they can play Ravel La Valse by themselves.
Right.
They don't need somebody showing them where 1, 2, and 3 is.
Right.
What they look for is somebody to give insight and focus, which is what the director for, you know, the music director for your operas or 101 or any of these things.
Which leads me to a question that I sort of poked at before we even started this program is, Stephen, you've done a lot of work as a director in your ensembles, the Calathumpian, the New England Conservatory Orchestra. You have directed and or conducted, but can you speak a little bit to the difference between conducting and directing? Maybe just kind of in general, but also as it relates to Cage. Are there clear distinctions between the two?
No, I don't think there are.
Stephen, here's a question. Can you conduct a piece with Calathumpian that you haven't directed?
Well, I don't. Yeah, you have to define directing.
Okay. So what's directing? You tell me.
First of all, I think we're not talking about stage directing,
No.
which I have done. And in some cases, in a very rudimentary level, you have to do that with some of Cage's music because you have to tell people how to get from, this position on stage to that position on stage without running into problems. But I think what we're talking about here is the idea of organizing and focusing to make clear to the players, first of all, in so much of John's music, just what the notation means, just what the ink on paper is inviting the players to do in the simplest way possible. The time bracket pieces are a good example of that because it's a little bit counterintuitive that the two sets of numbers on the left and the two sets of numbers on the right don't just mean, start anywhere, but that there's a window of starting and a window of stopping, and then you have to play both sides, and then you have to pay attention to the next bracket and how to get the players to think about that. Then how to get them to make those decisions for each event that they produce, each sonic event that they produce, how to get the players to decide in, say, etc., the first etc. piece, the chamber piece, how to let them think about when am I going to get up from my solo position and go over to one of the three conductor stations. They'll know when to leave because the conductor at that station says, okay, we're done, go back to your seats. Or for etc. 2/4 orchestras, how to give themselves the courage to get up while a conductor is giving a downbeat. Stand up from your chair and walk over to the other side of the stage, even though the conductor's getting ready for everybody to play. And then the hardest thing, outside of all the technical issues, the hardest thing is to feel like you can make decisions that contribute without falling into cliche. And this is something that I wrestle with when I play the solo stuff as well, the later solo stuff of John's, like the Etudes Australes, and maybe a little controversially, I've gone on record as saying that, it's the same thing as doing late Beethoven. I'm not at all sure John would like me to say that,
Well, how
but
so? But explain.
yeah, I think the first thing you're trying to do is get beyond yourself, is to imagine the universe of possibilities, but not let that rely on self-expression or self-aggrandizement, but to feel like you're exploring, and in the process of exploration, you discover things that weren't there anymore. A little bit like quantum mechanics. It's like the observation makes the thing. It wasn't there before you looked at it. It wasn't, before I decided to play that one note in the Etudes forte instead of mezzo piano, it wasn't there. And then what does that do? I'll give you a counterexample. I won't name the fellow, he's not with us anymore, but well known as a pianist and composer. I split a program with him doing the Cage, the Etudes Australes, all of it. And he would play entire Etudes with kind of half pedal and soft pedal and mezzo, very, very kind of evocative, and it sounded like bad Chopin. And
Kind of drifty and dreamy and
yeah, and it's ex exactly expressing something which, afterwards he said, yeah, well, John didn't like the way I played these pieces. I can see why, dude. And so what do you bring this note out because you want a contrast, or is wanting a contrast problematic? These are the same issues that come up when you're doing late Beethoven, or any real, Ives. I remember talking to John about the Etudes Australes, and he said he'd heard performances that were all kind of mezzo forte, and just these are the notes. And he says, at least they could use chance operations to have the contrast of sound. And I got stuck on those first two words, at least. And what could I do that was not going to use chance operations, but was going to open this universe? That's a long monologue, which kind of is an extended version of what I would talk to when I'm directing performers.
Yeah. So you are explaining the mechanics, the structure, the methodology, whatever it takes to convey how to make music out of what's in front of you.
And the spirit, most
importantly. Of course.
That's the clue. I mean, you can mess up, you know, if you play a wrong note in Cage, like I think he said somewhere, there are no wrong notes. Anything that happens authentically is. But if you play a C sharp instead of a C natural, it's not going to ruin the piece. Right. But if you play like, look at me, that's going to ruin the piece.
Right, right. I remember my piano teacher when I was in college. I don't remember the piece, but I was playing a piece and I made a mistake and I went, ugh. And he said, you've just made three mistakes. He said, you said, ugh, and you stopped.
Yep. Did you study with me? That sounds like things I say all the time.
Anyway, so another thing, I mean, all of this is fascinating, Stephen. Thank you. I've been wondering about a lot of these questions for most of my life. Another question I would have is, how much of what you've been saying relates to ensemble work? You know, I think about the solo pieces where you have to make these determinations in the course of your solo performance. But what about those pieces, you know, the string quartet, for example, you know, the four that the Arditi played so beautifully, where they change parts and it's really nice. But they are having to not only do what you were just talking about with regard to their own materials, but they're listening at the same time to what's going on around them and fitting things together or not fitting things together, you know, making those kinds of decisions.
Well, I did talk to Irvin about that once, about specifically playing that piece. And he said, well, you know, in the quartet, we like to make chords. And so they use the flexibility of the numbers to produce a harmony. I think they do it with such elegance and control that it doesn't interfere. It doesn't get in the way of the freedom of the piece. I can imagine that being done badly, again, to kind of show everybody how pretty it is. But I, you know, and that's on one side of the thing. And of course, Cage loved the way they played. And the other side of that is Cage's own instructions, which are play like you don't hear anybody else.
Right.
Completely independent.
Christian quoted that line in some setting we were in together, I don't know, in the last few years, probably pre-COVID. It was in Leeds. It was at the conference in Leeds. And he said that turned him off so much when Cage instructed performers to play together, but don't listen to them. You know, don't pretend you're alone. It really, really bothered him.
Well, I think that's a place to start from. I think if you start with that idea, in the same way that you start with every voice in a Bach fugue is an independent line. Mm. And then with the kind of attention of getting out of yourself as a performer, as a collection of likes and dislikes, starting from that and using that as a tool to hear things that you wouldn't have heard otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's true.
You know, again, it reminds me a little bit of some of the Earl Brown smaller pieces where he demands a conductor. Piece like Times Five of Earl Brown's, it don't need a conductor. Mm-hmm. You can, if you got five players who know and who care, you don't need somebody saying, you play now, no, quit playing. That's one way to do it. But I think just, you know, we expand our experiences and it's not like it gets better, but there are more possibilities for interpretation.
Do you want orchestral music, Cage's orchestral music at least, to be played as if it were chamber music?
Well, I, you know, like what we're talking about now, I think he would start with the idea of, no, play it like It's 101 solo pieces.
Right, right.
And then your awareness of what's going on as a musician leads you to places that you wouldn't get either by just being a soloist or by, okay, let's play a nice sound with what the trombone is playing here, because that nice sound is a limitation rather than an encouragement to unheard.
Any musician will tell you that the minute you do that, it's really hard to get back to not doing that, get out of it.
Yes, I really think to me anyway, that really isn't any different from what I try to do if I'm doing the second movement of Beethoven 111 or Ives Thoreau or Lachenmann's Serenade, which is to get past what's approved, to get past what's approved, to get past expressions of myself. When I'm a performer, I want to become more than I am. What I am is pretty limited. I mean, who cares?
Right.
And I'm sorry, the same is true for any number of performers I could mention that get paid a lot more than I do. Who cares? I want more than you on stage. And that's one of the invitations that John's music gives us.
Right, right. You reminded me of a very funny story. I'm trying to remember the piece. I think it was Ange et Dieu, which was the Cunningham piece. What was the music for Ange et Dieu?
Oh, yeah. One day.
Was it Et Cetera? It might have been Et Cetera.
I think it might
have been. But why I bring this up is that premiered at the Paris Opera Ballet.
Mm.
It was a ballet. And Merce had gone over to prepare them.
Maybe the second Et Cetera, come to think of it.
I can't remember now, but the point of this whole story was that the musicians got really pissed off because what John's piece was requiring of them was so much more than what they'd been taught as an orchestral player. And so they went to the administration of the Paris Opera Ballet and said that they wanted more money to do the cage piece. And this got back to John and Merce, and John was mortified that he had caused this grief, and the next time he saw the director, whose name I'm never going to remember in this setting. Anyway, when he saw the director in the hallway, he went up to him and he apologized. And the person said, the man said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, I heard that the players came to you and wanted more money. And he said, "John, don't worry about it. They're French. They would have wanted more money anyway."
Exactly. Nice.
Stephen, we have to wrap up. We need to leave some time for music, which we don't even know what we're going to play yet. So we'll be talking about that. But thank you so much. It's been really enlightening for me, and I hope it helps bring Cage's orchestral works a little closer to people who don't know them.
What a joy to talk about it with you, Laura. And I hope I see you in the flesh one of these days.
I know. It will happen. I just know.
All right. Great.
Take care of yourself, kiddo.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Now on to John Cage's 101. Enjoy. Thank you.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.